The Guardian.
Welcome to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. It surely can't be only a week ago that we just witnessed the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. So much has happened since then, it feels like a different age. Because in the week that's passed, we've had the president testing positive for COVID-19. His subsequent helicopter ride to the Walter Reed Medical Center, his spin in the back seat of an SUV, and then his return to the White House with the most famous balcony scene since Romeo and Juliet, not forgetting his upbeat video message once he was back.
Don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it.
It's all so much that we cannot stick to our usual practice of tackling one big question about the election. We are going to have to do two. So first, will Donald Trump's handling or mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic be his undoing? The one thing that finally brings him down. And while there's all these headlines about the president's health and the health of his staff at the White House, which has become a serious corona cluster, and the health of the country, there also seems to be an interesting shift underway in the so-called swing states, those battlegrounds that are up for grabs. So what can the swing states tell us about modern American politics? But let's start with our first question, whether coronavirus is, at long last, the one problem that Donald Trump cannot talk himself out of. To discuss it, I'm joined by The Guardian US columnist Moira Donegan. Moira, great to have you on the show. It does seem almost impossible to believe, as we record now, that it's barely been a week, not yet a week, since it was announced that Donald Trump had tested positive for coronavirus. It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yes, Jonathan, I've aged quite a lot in the past week.
We're not going to be counting grey hairs, although they are definitely coming through this election cycle. There has been a huge focus, as I said, on the president's own illness, just the fact he got it, to then being taken to hospital and then, you know, leaving hospital earlier than really most people thought was likely or even perhaps sensible. And then, of course, that upbeat message saying, you know, I've learnt a lot and feeling great, feeling better than I did 20 years ago. How does this all play, Moira, for him politically?
Well, the first thing that you need to understand is that here in the U.S., there's a tremendous amount of distrust of the White House and Donald Trump's depiction of his health. Close to 70% of Americans in a recent poll said that they didn't trust what the White House was telling us about the president's health. And, you know, there's been quite a bit of mixed messaging. As you say, Donald Trump himself is appearing in these somewhat bizarre proof of life videos. He is removing his mask on the balcony of the White House like Eva Perón. And he is trying very hard to depict strength in his statements about his experience with the virus. He has framed it as a matter of dominance. He said, don't let the virus dominate you. And, you know, he's trying to depict his own supposed health as a matter of masculine robustness and virility.
That is so much what this is about. And I wondered if some of his base do think, wow, he's Superman. You know, he's got this disease that everyone told us was a killer disease. Most people they know, if they know people are in hospital for a week or 2 weeks or three, he's out within a couple of days and he's back doing his videos and tweeting again.
You know, I'm sure that's what he would like his base to think, that he is defeating this virus because of some superhuman masculine robustness or physical capacity on his part. I'm not sure that people buy it. Nobody knows. About 70% of Americans distrust information from this White House, and how he's actually doing is not clear. However, I think what he wants to portray is tremendous strength, tremendous personal vitality. But, you know, 210,000 Americans have died of this disease, and quite a few Americans are in mourning or know somebody who passed. And the implication from Trump being that those people who succumbed to this disease simply weren't tough enough or simply weren't manly enough to overcome it, casts their death as a moral failure. And I don't think people are going to like that depiction of their loved ones.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really profound point. Before we leave, just this question, you've talked about his appeal to kind of machismo, and we've talked about the sort of Superman thing and free medication. What about just this notion of freedom itself. It's obviously a core American value. And he, by ripping the mask off when he did this balcony appearance, when he ripped the mask off, and now just in the, as you and I record now in the last few minutes, Donald Trump has said he refuses to debate at the second debate virtually. He won't do a remote debate because he wants to be there in person. Do all of these things tap into the idea of freedom as a sacred value? I should be free not to wear a mask. I should be free to walk into a room and be indoors without perspex barriers or without virtual links. Does that strike a chord with anyone but his core base?
You know, there is a very recurring, very consistently recurring theme in the Trump world in which following the rules is depicted as a kind of weakness and breaking them is depicted as a kind of strength. You know, that's very consistent. He depicts his relations with women that way. He depicts his relations in business and with his taxes and with his debt in that way. And so that he is also flouting coronavirus precautions as a demonstration of his machismo is not exactly surprising. You know, you saw at the first presidential debate just a few days before Trump tested positive, he and his entourage arrived late and declined testing and declined to wear masks. And that was a statement of their power, right? We don't have to follow the rules because we are better than those who follow the rules. But, you know, along with personal individual freedom, there is also this accompanying American value of individual responsibility. A majority of American voters think that he has not handled his own diagnosis responsibly. You know, there is a popular understanding that because he does not want to follow the rules, he is endangering the welfare of other people.
Markets are falling after President Trump announced on Twitter that he is ending all negotiations on any sort of coronavirus relief deal.
He, the president, and the administration were in talks over on Capitol Hill, you know, between Republicans and Democrats to broker a stimulus package to, you know, bail out those Americans who are in dire financial need, and indeed industries in dire need, like the aviation industry and others. And Donald Trump, straight out of hospital, broke off those talks and said, right, we're only going to resume them after the election, that I'm sure I'm going to win. This was a big deal. What about that in terms of how that impacts and affects regular Americans, this delay of at least a month in having any kind of cash bailout for Americans who are strapped? What's the impact of that, Moira?
Yeah, there is a bizarre situation happening on Capitol Hill in which each party is sort of working against its own interests, right? So the Democrats have been trying to get a relief bill passed, even though a poor economy somewhat helps their chances in the November election. And the Republicans, who desperately need economic relief in an election year to keep control of the Senate and the White House, cannot get it together. They have a shambolic caucus, even in the Senate, that really lacks discipline and can't agree on getting this relief out. And now they have, in addition, the unreliable and sort of unpredictable behavior of a president who is blowing up his own reelection chances by declining to offer relief to struggling Americans. You know, there's this Teflon Don image of Donald Trump. You know, nothing sticks to him. He can make all these mistakes. And it's true that he has a minority base of support that is fervent and very loyal and not likely to leave him. But he also has a degree of soft support and did in the 2016 election. And, you know, none of these previous mistakes he has made have caused or worsened an economic recession in an election year. And this one does.
Your mention of the word Teflon there brings us to our question in a way, which is, as rightly you point out, that he has survived extraordinary things that most other politicians would have been crushed by. What are the stories that stay in your mind as ones where when you first heard them, you thought, right, even he can't possibly survive this?
You know, there was a moment where he mocked the physical disability of a politics reporter.
The poor guy, you got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
There was, of course, the Access Hollywood tape, which I think was very viscerally upsetting for a lot of American women to hear.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
And 4 years ago to the day, 4 years ago to this day as we speak now, that tape leaked out. It's obviously notorious because he talks, boasts, brags really about grabbing women and sort of, you know, sexually assaulting them. I remember that one and hearing that and thinking, it's got to be over. Surely now it's over. We thought that that was surely impossible for any politician to survive. And yet he did survive. And you've listed a whole lot more that most normal politicians wouldn't survive. In a word, more, I mean, not, you know, in two words, how come?
There are some parts of this that are particular to Donald Trump, and there are some parts of it that are eccentricities of the American political system, right? So Donald Trump has never pretended to be a person of principle and dignity. He is not capable of shame. And so the sort of frank embrace of all of these repugnant features of his character, I think, has sort of been a little disarming to a lot of people in the media. You know, there was a degree of misogyny at play in that election, which is not present in the 2020 cycle, simply because we have a male candidate on the Democratic ticket.
One thing I remember really wrong-footed me when I was reporting in America in 2016 was you'd speak to Trump voters and I would always ask them, what is it about him you like? They'd always say, well, I think he's a businessman. It's great. America needs a businessman. But they would often say, I like his honesty. He doesn't hide and fake it like other politicians who have all these sort of smarmy forms of words and fake sincerity. If he thinks John McCain's a loser, he'll say John McCain's a loser. And there was a body of people who think, well, if he's admitting it, where's the scandal? There's no hypocrisy. Whereas with other normal politicians, it's that gap between what they're saying publicly and the reality that makes people think they're insincere, makes them then feel a bit ashamed. And Trump, since he doesn't have that gap, is somehow kind of liberated, and therefore no scandal can hurt him.
Yeah, you know, I think that's exactly right. You know, people do not like being condescended to. It's very hard to talk about all Americans at once because there's just so many of us. But I do think there is a national allergy to pretension. And people really have a degree of cynicism about national politicians that is very deep-seated. And there is a sense of relief among some people with Donald Trump that he seems to be copping to his own mendaciousness and cruelty, whereas a different kind of politician would be that mendacious and cruel but would not admit to it.
Do you think then, to come back to our question, will this be the problem, scandal, shame that ultimately undoes Donald Trump in a way that means his survival is no more because of this pandemic?
You're right. The coronavirus is different. People, particularly women, have been driven from the workforce in droves. Children can't go to school. Nobody can go to a restaurant or to go see a movie. You know, our lives have been warped and constrained. And a lot of us in the U.S. are in mourning. You know, we have buried 210,000 of our Americans, and many of them died alone. There is an anger about the handling of this virus that is quite palpable, particularly when we see other countries handling this much more successfully and beginning to return to normal life after proportionally much smaller death tolls. You know, there's an anger that is quite potent in the electorate right now.
Maura Donegan there in New York, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
After the break, we look at why Donald Trump should be worrying about the swing states. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly Extra. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, as Trump's inner circle, those that are not laid up with coronavirus, that is, tries to keep up with the president's health, Republican pollsters will be looking anxiously at the numbers coming out of America's swing states. And to discuss that with me, I have The Guardian US political correspondent Lauren Gambino with me. Lauren, great to have you on again. Let's start really simple. What is a swing state?
What is a swing state? They're the sort of most important states in the election because they can determine the outcome. We don't have a simple popular vote, as I'm sure people remember from 2016. It goes state by state. And so these are the states where both candidates can compete. Both have a significant amount of support, and they're considered sort of toss-ups going into the election. And whoever wins them, or the combination of them, is likely to win the presidency.
Obviously, we know that last time there were crucial states like Ohio and Michigan, Pennsylvania, that had gone for Barack Obama in 2012 and then went to Donald Trump in 2016. I mean, before we get on to what's going to happen now or what is happening now, is there sort of an accepted, received explanation for why those swing states swung to Trump 4 years ago?
CNN now projects that Donald Trump will carry the state of Wisconsin. He will win Wisconsin.
CBS News projects that when all the votes are counted, Trump will win in Michigan.
Some big news here, Megan. Huge news. Actually, the AP now projecting that Donald Trump has won the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes. And the short answer is yes. Trump did really well in what we call these Rust Belt Midwestern states, like you mentioned, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, which had been, you know, all these states had been a Democratic stronghold for a long time, at least at the presidential level. But Trump did really well among white working class voters there. And they were sort of overrepresented compared to many of the other states throughout the country. And pollsters kind of underestimated the impact of their electoral support and their support for Donald Trump, because many of them are what Democrats call ancestral Democrats. They voted for JFK and have, you know, families have voted for Democratic presidents every cycle since. But Trump really appealed to these voters, and it happened to be in these critical swing states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and no one actually expected Wisconsin.
We have a major projection right now. Donald Trump will take Ohio. CNN projects Donald Trump will.
And he also did well in Ohio, which is sort of the perennial swing state. The adage is, as goes Ohio, as goes the presidency. And so far, Ohio has been pretty good at predicting who will win the presidency, and Trump indeed won it in 2016.
I mean, how many states that voted Republican last time that Trump, you know, did win in 2016, how many of those would we say he could afford to lose this time and yet still win the election? I mean, what is exactly his headroom here? Or does he absolutely have to have a kind of sweep the board, win the whole lot?
His path is incredibly narrow just because of the way he won last time. He, you know, his margins were so small. And, you know, I think the one thing most strategists will agree on is that he really needs Florida. If you don't win Florida, it starts to look almost impossible. He would have to pull out, you know, an incredible victory somewhere where no one expects it. So I think for him, the big focus is probably Florida. And then in addition to Florida, he needs to win all of these three, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. You know, there is some maneuvering there, the combinations, there's some maneuvering. But, you know, especially because when you look at the rest of the map, he's vulnerable in states that Republicans haven't really been vulnerable in before. And so it makes these other states that much more crucial. It's just, he's got an incredibly narrow path. And Biden, at least when you look at the electoral map, Biden has many more paths to victory, and he can cobble together different combinations of states.
Now, The Guardian is tracking six of these swing states, that all states that Trump flipped in 2016 from Republican to Democrat. And we're also publishing polling figures on two states that in the past would not have been deemed swing states. Tell us about those.
So we're watching North Carolina and Arizona. These are two states that are part of what we call the Sun Belt states. And these are the states where we expect to see Democrats be much more competitive over in the coming years, just because of the diversity of the state. It's growing, meaning there's more young people moving in and families coming in from all over the rest of the country. And that's changing the political dynamics there in these states. You know, I would say this is just the tip of the iceberg. These two states, we will see, I'm sure in the future, we'll have Georgia, maybe even Texas, if you can believe it, as one of these states that we're watching as a swing state. But for now, we're looking at North Carolina, which looks very competitive, and then Arizona, which actually looks very good for Biden.
You recently, despite the pandemic, you took a trip to Arizona. You did some on-the-ground reporting, and I want us to talk for a little bit about that. Why did you head there?
So I'm from Arizona.
Ah, that's a good reason right there.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been, it's a state I've been watching, obviously, incredibly closely just because it's my home state, and Democrats there have been predicting that it will change for probably the last 10 years. And that's because if you look at all of its neighbors, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, they've also all changed and become much more Democratic as their demographics have changed. But for the first time, it seems like a Democratic president could actually win it.
But your larger point is so right, which is experts have been telling us that this change, the Sun Belt going Democratic, is always just around the corner. It's always kind of the day after tomorrow. And I remember there was one analysis of 2016, which said, you know, the Democrats' problem is, you know, the Rust Belt was shifting Republican faster than the Sun Belt was going Democratic. And so Donald Trump sort of managed to get in just in that little time lag there. So did you come away from your trip with some confidence that maybe the day after tomorrow is about to come today, as it were, and that finally that breakthrough is coming?
Yes, and for a couple reasons, I think. In Arizona, you have a really interesting mix of all these national trends happening across the country. So you have this growing population of Latinos, but you also have around Phoenix, you just have these massive rings of suburbs. And the suburbs in the US are changing. I think the more suburbs start to resemble cities, the more they start to vote like cities. So the more dense and diverse that these suburbs are getting, the more likely they are to vote for the Democrat. We've seen it in 2018.
The Arizona Senate race between Democrat Kyrsten Sinema and Republican Martha McSally. Moments ago, Congresswoman McSally conceded.
Arizona elected for the first time in decades. They sent a Democratic senator to the U.S. Senate. And the suburbs have been changing for a while. White voters who are college educated, especially women, we've seen them sort of move and migrate towards the Democratic Party. But that's been completely accelerated by Trump. Under Trump, we've seen sort of a mass migration, if you will, away from Republicans to the Democratic Party of these sort of white educated suburbanites and especially suburban women.
I would have thought that it would be absolutely obvious that the Latino vote in the United States would be just solidly anti-Trump, as you know, not necessarily anti-Republican, but anti-Trump, simply because of how hardline he's been on immigration, child separations at the border, where often the people on the receiving end of that very harsh treatment are, of course, from Latin America, Central America, Spanish-speaking the countries. These are the people who are on the sharp end of Trump's often really brutal policy. And yet you look at polling that says he still gets, there is a sort of quite chunky number that he manages to get of Latino support in the country, much higher than he gets among African-American voters or other minorities. What is that about?
The Latino community is so vast, and it's truly not a monolith. And you can go state by state and you can really see that. In Arizona, for example, a lot of the immigrant population is from Mexico specifically. But you move over to Texas, many of the Latino population there, they're from more Central America. You go to Florida, it's a population of Cubans, and they're much more conservative. So these differences do show up in how Latinos vote. There is a strong tradition of being, you know, Catholic or Christian among Latinos, and often they the ones who will vote for Trump or vote for Republicans prioritize abortion as a voting issue, or are attracted to Republicans saying they're the party of family values. Particularly in Florida, Cuban Americans have been very supportive of Republicans and have sort of powered the Republican Party there. And Trump is actually tied with Biden among Latinos in the state.
Let me ask you about the other group you mentioned, that is women.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody. Nobody has more.
You know, again, from based on your face-to-face encounters, presumably at 2 meters distance, but when you were encountering women voters in Arizona, did you yourself pick up a shift? Were you finding people, or was it easy to find people who had voted for Trump in 2016 and were moving away now?
Anecdotally, yes. Looking at the raw numbers from 2016 to 2018, you have to believe that there is a significant number of women who voted for Trump in 2016 and then voted for a Democratic senator in 2018. I have spoken to plenty of women, and a lot of them had actually changed their minds already by 2016. But these were lifelong Republicans who didn't want to vote for a Democrat. And actually, because of Trump, over the last 4 years, have, you know, now marched in the women's rally, marched in climate change rallies, joined gun control, like truly had this entire political awakening, and are now very active and making calls for the Joe Biden campaign. And this political transformation, I mean, I've even seen it sort of personally among some of the people I've grown up with, definitely would have considered themselves conservative Republicans, and who've just completely walked away from the party.
And these are people who would have backed Trump 4 years ago?
Some, yes. Some I've seen, even just on Facebook, you know, friends sort of, I was wrong to do that, and now are going to vote for Biden.
And is there one thing they point to that says, this is why I did it, this was the last straw for me?
It's so interesting, because for everyone, there's just different points at which it all snaps.
The kids, they're separating the children. Mr. President, don't you have kids? Don't you have kids, Mr. President?
I think for a lot of women, it was child separation at the border. I think the idea of taking a child from their parents was too much. You know, for Arizona, especially, his comments on John McCain.
He's not a war hero.
He's a war hero.
He's a war
Five
hero.
And a half years
He's
a
war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay? I hate
to... You know, after this Atlantic report that we saw just a few weeks ago kind of revived a discussion about Trump's comments on John McCain, and then Trump doubled down and said,
I've never liked them much. Hasn't been for me.
In a state where John McCain's an icon, that sort of, I think, angered people again. And I spoke to a veteran who said he's been hearing from a lot of his Republican friends that said, that's enough. It's too much. I won't vote for him again.
Just thinking about where you've been, there's a month more to go. What would Trump have to do to turn things around in Arizona and in states, swing states like Arizona? And do you think he might be able to do it?
It's going to be really hard, because Arizona, something we didn't mention, but I should say quickly, is one of the states that was devastated by the coronavirus. And here, like in other states devastated by the coronavirus, we're seeing seniors even pull away from Trump. And seniors are so important to his coalition. And in Arizona, it's a retiree state, plenty of senior communities. These are people who probably haven't seen their families in weeks or months. They're not leaving their homes. And to see the president, after being diagnosed with coronavirus, come out and say, you shouldn't let this dominate your lives. It's, you know, it's just like the flu. It's not that bad. I think unless he is able to sort of give a mea culpa on this, say that he underestimated the severity and understands the impact on Americans across the country who's lost loved ones, I just don't see how he's really going to turn it around, because I think people just want sort of stable leadership. And unless he's able to really come out, define how he would go forward with this pandemic, how he plans to address the economy, how he plans to distribute a vaccine and really get a handle on this this virus, then I just don't see him being able to change people's minds on much else.
So America's older voters pulling away from Donald Trump because of the coronavirus pandemic, very much what we heard earlier from Moira Donegan in the first half of the podcast. Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter for The Guardian US, thank you for joining me. And again, to Moira Donegan for talking to me earlier on. Now, last week I stayed up to watch the first presidential election debate with Richard Wolff, and I'm not going to say I enjoyed watching the debate exactly, but it was fascinating to break down what we had just witnessed, although maybe the right word for that is endured. So I'm going to do it again. For the next 2 weeks, I will be staying up late and tuning in to the follow-up debates between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. It's impossible to know what to expect, especially as Donald Trump, as we record, is not even committing to doing the debate the way the organisers want it to be, remotely. Nevertheless, a colleague and I will do our best to present some fresh and, we hope, illuminating analysis as soon as it is done. So just look for that in the usual Politics Weekly feed on Friday mornings. But for now, it's goodbye. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Take care, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.